Hello, friends, and welcome once again to the Foundry Church Sermon Podcast. My name is Joseph. I'm the worship pastor here at the Foundry Church in Winter Springs, Florida, coming to you this week from my home office because it's that weird in-between week where my wife is back at work, but my kids are not in school yet. So I'm working from here with them. We started a new series this week titled Mountains and Seas and Gardens and Roads. And what you're about to hear is the first message, is kind of the intro message to that series, where Seth talks about how the typical understanding we have of what the gospel accounts in Scripture are doing is maybe not the full picture. It's maybe incomplete would be a good way to say it, that it's not just four separate accounts of the life of Jesus that agree on all the major details, and where there are differences, it's color, it's character, it's, you know, things that don't change the overall story. And Seth talks in this message, and we're going to be talking over the following 8 weeks that are part of this series, about how a very ancient understanding of the Gospels was actually to view the four Gospel accounts together as sort of a path, sort of answering different questions, using different key imagery in order to, as I said, sort of answer these key questions through, you know, the story of Jesus and Jesus' time on earth and his ministry and death and resurrection and all that kind of stuff. I'm very excited for this series. I think it's going to be a really cool one. I think it's going to expand our, you know, our understanding of what the gospel accounts are and what they are doing in some cool ways. And so I'm excited for you to take this journey with us. We hope that you enjoy this first message from our newest series, Mountains and Seas and Gardens and Roads.
Good morning. Welcome, welcome. I'm so very glad you're here, whether you're joining us in person or online. My name is Seth, and this is The Foundry, where we're all about a better you and a better world. I just got really nervous for some reason. Have you ever had that, like, out of nowhere? Like, we do this a lot. We do this many times a year, and I just got really nervous. I don't, no reason. Something about you guys today is different. Who is it? Anyways, so today, we wrapped up our party series last week, which means the fun is over, and now it's just normal, boring church stuff. The kids aren't here, so there's no gum, but also there's no, like, feral children that are going to be just running around, so we should be okay. So we begin a new series that we're calling Mountains and Seas and Gardens and Roads, and so basically what we're going to be doing is looking at the four Gospels. But we're going to be looking at them from kind of a different perspective than you might be used to. Okay, so often when it comes to how we think about the Gospels and how we interact with them and how we approach them, the understanding has been that the Gospels are all telling the same story, but they're just telling it from a slightly different perspective, right? A slightly different focus. Like, growing up, I remember hearing the analogy of, like, how we understand the Gospels as, like, being at an intersection. Have you heard this? Let's say we're all at an intersection, and then we all witness, like, a car crash or something, and then the police show up, and they start taking reports, and they want to hear, like, how you saw it, whatever, and then so we all start giving our different perspective on how we saw it based on our angle and who was there first, and so all of our perspectives are going to be slightly different based on where we are standing in relation to the accident. We'll include some details. You'll miss some details. I won't, whatever. And then the police take all those reports, and then they go, okay, when we combine all this, now we have, like, a more complete, accurate picture of what actually happened, right? So this is kind of the traditional way of understanding how the Gospels work together. But this isn't how the church always understood the Gospels to work. There's actually a more traditional way to understand and interact with the Gospels than our traditional way of thinking about the Gospel, right? There's actually, the early church arranged the books, arranged the Gospels in such a way that they weren't just four retellings of the same story, but they were understood as four different stories that are actually working together to create, like, one larger journey. And that this journey that we're intended to go on through these Gospels is a journey of radical transformation. So that's kind of what we're going to be looking at through this series. Now, most of this work is not original to me. It's based on some work, research done by Dr. Alexander Shaya. I'm kind of following his path here. I've been reading through this stuff for like over a year now. It's really, really fascinating stuff. So I hope that you will be open to just this kind of way of thinking and approach to the Gospels. Okay, so today will be kind of a setup. And then the next several weeks, we'll take a couple of weeks on each gospel, and we'll be going through, and I'm going to lay this all out for you today, kind of what it is and the general approach, okay? So today, we're going to look at some of the history behind this. We're going to give you a summary of how to understand and approach each gospel, and then we'll talk a little bit about, like, well, why does it even matter, okay? So before we get into the history of some of this, just so you can kind of see where this is going, okay? So Dr. Shaya suggests that each gospel was written to a specific community and that each gospel is dealing with a particular question. Each gospel has some particular imagery built into it, and this imagery seems to highlight and support the question that's being asked, okay? So when you put all these questions in order, what you end up with is this path, this like reoccurring path that leads to deeper transformation, okay? So stay with me. So here's how it works. So the Gospel of Matthew is asking and answering the question of how do we face change? And then the key imagery in the Gospel of Matthew is the mountain. Okay, so this is what Matthew's about. Then you get into the Gospel of Mark, and the Gospel of Mark is asking and answering the question, how do we move through suffering? And then the key image for Mark is either the desert or the stormy seas. You get into the book of John. John is asking and answering the question, how do we receive joy? In which the key image for John is the garden, right? And then you get into the book of Luke, and Luke is asking and answering the question of how do we mature in service? And then the key image in Luke is the road, okay? So the four questions are, how do we face change? How do we move through suffering? How do we receive joy? And how do we mature in service? And so the idea is that this is this kind of reoccurring path that leads to something deeper transforming within us. This is also why we're calling the series like Mountains and Seas and Gardens and Roads, which I am aware is like a super clunky title, right? Like I get that, but I figured it was like, we're gonna repeat this enough that hopefully this will kind of like create this pattern in your mind. Now, maybe the bigger question here is like, how come we've never heard this before? Maybe you knew this. I didn't know this until I started reading this stuff. How come we've never heard of this kind of way of thinking towards the gospel before? That's a great question. Now, Dr. Shaya has a ton of evidence and support for this, but it's about as exciting as watching like paint dry. So I'm just gonna kind of give you the summary of this, okay? So leading up until like up until the 7th century, like 600 CE, this was a part of how the early Christians practiced and related and interacted with the four gospels. So this system, this like fourfold pattern, was actually used for hundreds of years up until the 6th century, or 7th century, 600 CE. And then under the influence of the Roman Church, under the influence of one of the popes, the church was under a lot of attack at this time. And so they decided, this collective religious group decided that they needed like a simpler way for their people to like go through and understand and approach the Gospels. So they moved away from this three-year reading cycle and this fourfold approach to the Gospels, and they replaced that with like this simpler lectionary of like 52 Sunday lessons that they could go through in a year. And then those 52 lessons were based on different pieces and bits from the various gospels. And they did this in a way that they moved to this more of a timeline, linear, more succinct biography of the life and the teachings of Jesus. Okay, so the result being in shifting from the pattern in the three-year cycle to this linear teaching is that rather than seeing all of the gospels as this transformational path, we now began to focus on like the details of the life and the personality of Jesus, which is what we see in like modern Christianity today. So in the 1940s, okay, we fast forward several centuries. In the 1940s, the Catholic Church opens its like libraries for like general like people checking out like all the stuff they have stored. And so somebody comes across this ancient three-year reading cycle, which goes back to the 7th century. And so they're like, oh, this is like, seems to be really important. This seems to be like something that some of the early church guys were doing. And so maybe we should begin to do this. So by 1970, like 30 years later, they discover it in 1940. 1970, they begin to incorporate this new, not so new, three-year reading cycle into the Catholic Church. So much so that Like, they incorporated it through, like, all of their churches worldwide, which means they had enough support and evidence and belief in what was happening to, like, change how their institution functions, right? So 1970s, that's all happening. That gets going. The issue was they brought back the three-year reading cycle, but they didn't include, like, this deeper fourfold sequence to the Gospels. So then you get, like, a little bit further. You get into the 80s and stuff, and then you have, like, the Presbyterians and the all the high church people that are following the three-year reading cycle. So if you have a high church background, you're probably familiar with, yeah, we used to do that cycle. Well, that didn't start until the 70s, which actually was a reinventing of the thing that was actually happening in the 7th century. But then when they started it again, they missed out on this deeper underlying significant thing, right? So it was all—it's all good. It's all good. It's not taking away anything from what you're trying to do. The goal was to, like, help their members have a more complete picture and understanding of the Gospels, which is good. But they were just kind of missing this, like, deeper, this little deeper significance to it. So basically, the believers, the early believers, up until and around the 7th century, understood the four Gospels not as one story told four different times, but as four individual texts written to four different communities with four distinct sets of challenges based on historical circumstances. And these historical circumstances prompted these four deeper questions that the people were looking for answers for. And these four Gospels are the four answers that help lead to spiritual maturity, which actually is kind of cool. Like, oh, it's... there's the story of Jesus, which is awesome and exciting and important, but then there's this, like, path, the spiritual path found within the stories of Jesus as well, right? It's fascinating to me. So, excuse me. Okay, so let's get into looking at, a bit of a larger explanation of this. It's a summary, but it's a brief summary, but it's a not-so-brief summary of each of these Gospels, what the questions were, and why they were significant to the people at the time, okay? So it starts with the Gospel of Matthew. This is the first path. The question of Matthew is, on this part of the journey, is how do we face change, right? And so the imagery, again, is the mountain. This is what we see in the book of Matthew a lot. So Matthew's gospel is written to the Messianic Jews of Antioch, and they're these Jewish people who are, like, they're followers of Christ, right? So they believe in the Messiah. This book was written a few years after the destruction of the temple in 70 CE. Now, the destruction of the temple was a huge deal for the Jewish people, and I think sometimes we don't fully understand or connect with, like, how big of a deal this would have been for the people, right? The temple was the center of their lives. The temple was the center of their faith. It was the center of their religious practice and their sacrificial system. The temple was the dwelling place of God, and so to have this destroyed was absolutely devastating, right? So not only is that taken from them, which is devastating, but also how the Romans did it was so very brutal, right? You have to understand, like, this is like ripping your heart out if you're a Jewish person, okay? So let me show you how Josephus writes about the destruction of the temple, okay? Just to give you a flavor for what was happening. As the legions charged in, neither persuasion nor threat could check their impetuosity. Passion alone was in command. Crowded together around the entrances, many were trampled by their friends. Many fell among the still hot and smoking ruins of the colonnades and died as miserably as the defeated. Everywhere was slaughter and flight. Most of the victims were peaceful citizens, weak and unarmed, butchered wherever they were caught. Round the altar, the heaps of corpses grew higher and higher, while down the sanctuary steps poured a river of blood, and the bodies of those killed at the top slithered to the bottom. When we talk about the destruction of the temple, this is what we're talking about. This is a huge, devastating blow to the Jewish community. They are dealing with this intense grief at everything they have lost in this moment. This is really hard to recover from. Like, how do you come back from this? This community had their heart ripped out from them. They're scattering. They're alone. They're afraid. Their whole identity is being smashed to bits. So when Matthew uses the imagery of the mountain in his gospel, it's extremely intentional, right? The temple sat at Mount Moriah. Mount Moriah carried a great deal of significance for the Jewish people. It had been a holy place for a really long time. And so he knew and understand the power that the thought or the idea of a mountain would have for those people who have just had their world completely flipped upside down. These people who are living in fear and uncertainty. What do we do now? So Jesus steps into the scene, right? The beginning of Matthew, we have the genealogy, all that stuff. You get into chapter 3 in Matthew where Jesus is baptized. Chapter 4, he's tested in the wilderness, called his disciples. And then in chapter 5, Jesus begins to teach. And what does he teach? Watch what it says, Matthew chapter 5, verse 1. Now he went up, when Jesus saw the crowds, he went up on a mountainside and sat down. His disciples came to him and he began to teach. He went up on the mountainside. He went up on the mountainside, and what did he begin to teach? Next slide. To the people who have just faced this crazy amount of destruction, have had their lives ripped apart, he begins to teach, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Blessed are the weak, for they will inherit the earth. Oh, that would speak to you in that moment, wouldn't it? Right? Jesus gives them the Sermon on the Mount, which, by the way, is only recorded in the book of Matthew. And so in doing this, Jesus is bringing this whole new thought, this whole new way of living and being. In Matthew's gospel, Jesus teaches about a new kind of temple, a temple located within each individual. Right? The condition of your heart and your behavior was a matter of personal responsibility. Matthew's gospel, man, my throat. So what have you guys been up to? Just hanging out? Cool, me too. I'm trying not to die, apparently. What are we talking about? Temple. It's Jesus talks about a new temple, right? It's personal. It's within you. Matthew's gospel shows us how he understood the difficulty and the confession and the confusion that the people would have been facing, would have been experiencing. And so he's working and writing in such a way to bring comfort to the people through how he wrote and through how he structured his gospel. So this first path of the spiritual journey, the first question we ask is, how do we face change? Now, we all find ourselves at some point, like these Messianic Jews of Antioch, where we get into some deep turmoil in our lives, don't we? When something happens, something comes along, upends our world. Maybe it's the loss of a job. Maybe it's the loss of a loved one. Maybe it's a diagnosis of yourself or a loved one. Maybe it's the betrayal of a friend or a family member, and we're not prepared for it. How could we be prepared for it? And then this terrible thing happens, this unexpected thing happens, and then how do we feel about this? We're lost. We're alone. Desperately searching for answers. We're looking for anything or any way to make sense of it, to right the ship. We want to put the pieces of our lives back together, right? This is what Matthew's trying to help us to do, help us to sort through an answer in this gospel. How do we face change? Now, once we come to accept the reality that change has occurred, we now come to face like the difficulty of this. Like, now what do we do? Which leads us to the Gospel of Mark. Gospel of Mark, right? Mark is asking the question, how do we move through suffering? We've accepted the reality of the change, even if we're not like fully on board with it. But now things are going to get a bit difficult because now we have to live with that change, right? This is the stormy seas of Mark. So Matthew's writing to the Messianic Jews in Antioch. Mark is believed to be writing to the Jewish community in and around the port city of Ephesus. Of Ephesus. We can do it. We good? Okay. All right, back to it. So he's writing to the city in Ephesus, and he's expanding his audience. He's not just dealing with the Jewish, I'm in the wrong place, guys. Something is going on today, and it's weird. He's writing to the people in Rome. Should we start over? Can we go back and redo? Let's sing a song. Joe, just kidding. Okay, focus, people. We could do this. We could do this. I believe in us. Yeah. You know, here's the thing. When you're having an off day at your job, there's not a lot of people watching you. Is there? There's not people online typing, like, what is his deal today? Okay, let's focus. We can do this. Mark's not writing to the people of Ephesus. That's later. Mark's writing to the people of Rome. We got it. Now, Rome. So he's writing to the people of Rome, and what you have to realize at this moment, this is like the chaos that Emperor Nero is creating, right? In 64 CE, you have the Great Fire of Rome, which you've heard about, this fire that like burns for 7 days plus three. It destroys three of the 14 Roman districts. It disrupts seven of other ones, and like there's a lot of debate around how and who started the Great Fire of Rome, but essentially Nero uses this as an opportunity to blame the fire on the Christians, which now means the Christians have this big target on their back, right? Like now they're exposed to like this great deal of persecution. So it's said that the Roman soldiers would go door to door looking for followers of Jesus. They would be knocking, asking, "Do you follow this man?" Whatever. And if you said yes, then they would take you, potentially take your family. They would be taken away. They would be exposed to torture. They would be used as sport for the Circus Maximus. They would be used as human torches in Nero's garden, right? Like it was not a good place to be. So the Jewish community is filled with this hurt and despair. They're asking themselves, is this worth it? Is my life and possibly the life of my family worth following Jesus? The people he's writing to are in a bad place. They're suffering. The imagery of both the wilderness and the stormy seas are highlighted and serve to reflect the current dilemma of the people. So Mark's gospel presents us with both despair as well as hope. And it's kind of working together. And so the way that he presents the life and the teachings of Jesus was meant to ensure his readers that their suffering or maybe even their death was a part of something bigger. So he's writing in a way to help them see that God has not and God would not abandon them. And he's giving them this assurance that their time of suffering would eventually come to an end. Mark illustrates this really well in chapter 4 where Jesus calms a storm. If you're familiar with the story, Jesus and his disciples are crossing the sea in their little boat, and the storm kicks up, and the disciples start to panic, and then they're getting upset. What are we doing? What are we going to do? How are we going to make it out alive? Jesus apparently doesn't mind the storm, and so he's still sleeping. So they go to wake him up to like get him to chime in, get him some help. Watch what happens. Jesus was in the stern, sleeping on a cushion. The disciples woke him up and said to him, "Teacher, don't you care if we drowned?" Which might be how the people living in Rome would be feeling at this time, who were being persecuted by the Romans. He got up, rebuked the wind, and said to the waves, "Quiet, be still." Then the wind died down and it was completely calm. He said to his disciples, "Why are you so afraid? Do you still have no faith? Do you still have no faith that I can do this? Why are you so afraid?" It's a life lesson. It's an object lesson just continually happening here. So the second part of the journey can be scary and frightening, full of uncertainty, right? We're in our little boat. We're dealing with the stormy seas of life that's welling up around us. In this moment, we long to have someone to step in, to participate, to help remove or entirely like stifle the suffering that we're going through. We're just searching for peace and calm. The second path requires us to endure. You just kind of gotta hang in there, and it's in this path, this place that we're asking the question of how do I hang in there? How do I move through the suffering? Right? Things have changed. Whatever it is in your life, you can't go back to the way it was. The old ways won't work. You're moving towards a future that you cannot see and cannot comprehend. You don't know what it's going to be like yet. You've got all these competing voices and ideas in your head that you're attempting to sort through. So what Mark does is he helps us to understand, like essentially, like we have to die to the self, we have to die to the ego. We must cling to the hope of our faith through our prayer, through our meditation. We must remember that God has been faithful before, and we must trust that if Jesus wasn't worried about the storm, then we don't have to be either. How do we face change? How do we move through suffering? Eventually, we'll make it through these stormy seas of suffering, and we'll get to the other side. And then this is where we get to experience the joy and the wonder of John's garden. The key image for John is the garden, right? This is like the light bulb moment, the epiphany moment. You've climbed the mountain of Matthew. You've gone through that difficulty of change. You face the difficulty of the stormy seas and suffering. Now you have this aha moment with John, the moment where things like kind of start coming back together again, where you get a bit of clarity, where you get a bit of relief. You see, unlike the synoptic gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, John's gospel doesn't give like a timeline version of Jesus' life and experiences. John uses these long philosophical narratives that are usually tied to the metaphor of the garden, more specifically like the Garden of Eden, right? So the exact date of the Gospel of John is debated, but most believe he would have been writing to the Christians in the port city of Ephesus. We got that one right. Now you know. So Mark is Rome, John is Ephesus. Don't confuse us. I've heard that can happen, and then it causes problems. So John is the one expanding his audience from the Jewish people to the Gentile people. And he's attempting to establish a common and deeper grounding for the new Christians in this predominantly Gentile region. In John, what you see is you see a lot of miracles, a fair amount of symbolism, the oneness and unity of all things. John is the most like mystic, if you will, of all the Gospels. Think about how he opens the book, John 1:1. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Through him, all things were made. Without him, nothing was made that has been made. In him was life, and that life was the light of all mankind, the light that shines in the darkness, and darkness has not overcome it. John understood the human experience through the lens of wholeness. His focus seems to be on like attaining this like higher consciousness. His focus seems to be on this deeper inner knowing of the connection of all things, this inner knowing that the unity of all things is the thing that the place that we will find joy in John's garden. And after the difficulty of the struggles of Matthew and Mark, where life seems to be smashed into a bunch of bits, where it seems like everything is falling apart, out of nowhere, usually unexpected, all those smashed pieces start to come back together in like new and interesting sort of ways. All of a sudden, something will begin to make sense, something that you were missing before. You'll see the goodness that remains. You'll see the goodness that you've been overlooking because of everything you've been dealing with. Right? And it's in this place, this garden space, that you will find that calm, that peace, that joy that you've been looking for. So John is answering this question, we've been through all this stuff, how do I now receive joy? And what we see and learn in John is that the joy we're looking for, after everything we've been through, is found in this like inner stillness that we need to work to embrace. We take the hurt, we take the broken, we take all these bits of ourselves and we expose it to the light. And this is where we're met with love and acceptance. We find joy in the connection and oneness. It's in this place that we are refreshed, that we find healing, that we are brought back to life, that we come to this new perspective. Oh, I finally start to see this. I get it now. But here's the issue. You can't stay in John's garden forever because like this new thing that you've learned, this new truth that you've discovered, whatever, this new understanding comes with like responsibility. It's like you finally come to this place of joy, but like now what are you gonna do with that? Well, you have to take this new truth, this new reality. You must begin to incorporate it into your life. If you stay within the garden, that revelation that you've come to will begin to fade. It will remain immature, incomplete. So we must decide to leave the garden of enlightenment and continue on our journey. We must take this new perspective and begin to act on it. We must incorporate this new perspective into new practice, into new living, into a new way of being, which leads us to the Gospel of John. All right, Luke, excuse me. So Luke is written to assist and instruct various Christian communities throughout the Mediterranean region, these various Christian communities that were thriving in their faith, but also they were experiencing a great deal of pain at leaving their mother faith of Judaism, okay? The image, again, for Luke is the road. In the mid-80s CE, the Roman Empire started to become much more active in their oppression of the Christians. Their penalties and legal sanctions that were being enforced and kind of limited to Rome was now beginning to spread throughout the entire empire. So these early Christian communities are wrestling with, like, how do we deal with the hurt? How do we deal with these injustices that are being done against us because of what we believe. So everything we see happening in Luke is happening on the road. And the road is this metaphor where it's not so much the destination as it is the journey that is kind of the important bit in the metaphor, right? So Luke is continually calling the early Christians to like a deeper practice. He's continually asking them to change how they deal with and handle difficulty in crisis situations. He's inviting them to follow the example of Jesus and the disciples who faced oppression with compassion. He encourages them to trust in their spiritual practices and have the faith that they are, or that the thing that they were looking for would eventually come based on this continued maturity of how they are living. You can't keep doing the same thing the same ways and expect different results, right? You've come through you've come all the way to this new way of thinking and being. You've gone through the difficulties. You've had this moment of joy. You've had this like epiphany. Now you're living this thing out. Like you have to do something with what you've learned through this journey so far. So Luke invites the early Christians to move past their bitterness of being separated from their Judaism. He invites them to move past like conflict and fighting with the Romans. And he presents us with this idea that it's through these new disciplines, new practices, that they will be able to change, how they're living. Like the thing they're looking for will be found in these new practices. So Luke's gospel is filled with stories of compassion and service more than any other gospel. Luke chapter 10, we see this. On one occasion, an expert in the law stood up to test Jesus. "Teacher," he asked, "what must I do to inherit eternal life?" What is written in the law?" he replied. "How do you read it?" He answered, "Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, with all your mind, and love your neighbor as yourself." And then Luke like doubles down on this idea, right? That it's not just something you say you believe, it's like something you do, right? You carry out this belief through your actions. He supports this by going directly into the parable of the Good Samaritan. Parable of the Good Samaritan. "Who is my neighbor? The people you hate, you love them too." By the way, the parable of the Good Samaritan is only found in the Gospel of Luke. When we love God, when we love our neighbors as ourselves, the idea is that we should be compelled to live our lives in service to others. It's through putting our faith into practice that true transformation occurs. So in this fourth part, this fourth path, the question is, how do we mature in service? Right? Because faith is more than just like a theory or an ideal or a belief. Yes, we believe, but faith is about looking for growth and looking for maturity. You're putting this thing into practice. We're looking for this tangible way to live better. We're looking for this tangible way to create a better world. Jesus said, "I've come that you may have life and have it to the fullest." The fullness of life is not just an idea. It's not just an aspiration. It's the way that we as humans were intended to experience the time that we've been given. Which means if I want to experience the fullness of life, then I need to align my life with the teachings of Jesus. I need to begin to incorporate these daily practices that mirror the life of Jesus. This is how we grow. This is how we mature into the fullness of life. And then you'll never guess what happens as you're on the road to maturity. Just about the time you think you're getting a handle on things, something else will change. And this fourth part leads you back to the beginning, to Matthew's mountain. Something will change. And then you'll start this process and journey again. This is how we move forward. This is how we experience a deeper, more lasting transformation. This is like a part of how things seem to work. Once we get this, once we learn this, once we get hold of this, this is actually really, really helpful. Right? Here's the thing. Even if you knew nothing about this like history, this more traditional way to understand the Gospels, if you took the time to think about it, how your life has unfolded, the things you've been through, aren't these basically the questions we would be asking? Right? My guess is if you look back to your life and what you've been through, you, like me, would go, that seems pretty on point with stuff that I've gone through. Something changes in your life. It's really tough to deal with. Then you go through a time of suffering as you're trying to sort it out because you're trying to make sense of it. And then eventually you get beyond that and you come to this place of like revelation, this moment of seeing, this moment of clarity. But now you have to you can't just stay there. Like you have to do something with what you've learned through all that experience. You have to take what you've learned and put it into practice. That's been my experience, at least, right? Like, this is just kind of how it works. Here's the thing. This idea of the fourfold pattern, it isn't new. It isn't new. It's not new in the world. It's not new to Christianity. It isn't even limited to Christianity. The fourfold pattern is, like, kind of everywhere. It's almost, like, universal in nature. Think about the seasons, something as simple as the seasons. Isn't that the fourfold pattern? You start with fall. What's fall? There's a change, right? Which leads to what? Leads to winter, the death of winter, which is a time of scarcity, which is a time of, like, uncertainty. It represents this, you know, this time of death, which then leads you to spring, which is this time of growth, rebirth, this joy that is John's garden. Then you get into summer, which is where everything that started to grow in the spring is now growing to maturity. This is Luke's road. How do we mature in our actions? And then what happens? Well, you get back into fall again, where things change. This is how it works. This is how things work. And we accept that. We understand. We go, oh yeah, that's how that works. Maybe they did this intentional. Do you know? Right? The fourfold pattern is all over our natural world. In fact, in the early 2000s, a couple scientists by the name of West and Brown produced a bunch of research on what's known as scaling in nature, right? And this is kind of above my pay grade, so bear with me. But basically, scaling is like the relationship between internal systems within a larger growing body, so whether they're talking about animals, plants, humans, whatever, that as the body changes, the internal things have to change as well. And so what they realized through all their research was that how nature works, the way things change, the way things scale within the internal system, scale within a larger body, is always at a rate of 1 to 4. I don't know exactly what that means, but it's fascinating. And so they said it's not really 3 that's the magic number. We've been taught 3. They say actually 4 is the magic number of, like, creation, the magic number of nature. It's fascinating to me. Yeah, this is a part of, like, a lot of stuff. In the 2nd century, Bishop Irenaeus of Lyon said in defense of the Gospels as 4 different texts, he says this. He says, the natural activity of the Lord is fourfold. Oh, so maybe there's something to this, right? The hero's journey, if you've ever heard of this, the hero's journey is a fourfold path. There's the calling, the enduring of the obstacles, there's the receiving of the boon, and then there's the return to the community. Fourfold path, and it keeps happening. If you think about it, the Old Testament is the fourfold path. The journey of the Hebrew people is a fourfold path. They're rescued from slavery. How do we face change? They wander through the desert. How do we move through suffering? They enter into the promised land. It's the gospel, John's garden of joy. Then they must cultivate the promised land. It's Luke. How do we mature in service? Yeah, it's all here. It's all a part of this. So I'm excited to take this journey over the next several weeks. We'll be diving into these ideas, that the idea that rather than seeing the Gospels as, like, 4 different ways to tell the same story, which is good, right? We're not trying to take anything away from the timeline thinking of Jesus. We just want to supplement, want to add, want to like expand our understanding here, that now this ancient gospel, the sacred gospel, can be seen and understood as this integrated and inspired blueprint for our spiritual journey. Oh, that's pretty cool, isn't it? And the goal here is, like, just to bring more awareness to this idea, to the pattern, to help us eventually, like, become more engaged in what it means to follow Jesus, that we might do so in a way that actually leads to, like, deep life-changing transformation. And here's why I think this is important. I think it's important because, one, like, apparently, like, this is the way the early Christians did it. So it's worth, like, checking out. Like, oh, there was a reason. There was something that they were up to specifically that is intended to help us. Like, so we should look into that. The second thing I think is important is because modern Christianity seems to be, like, we place the majority of our focus on, like, the historical aspects of Jesus. He did this. He went here. He healed this. He fed them. Right? And that's fine. That's okay. But I think maybe the downside to the historicity of Jesus alone is that we miss out on the dynamic aspects of the living Christ, right? The living Christ that is with us, that is among us now. Like the author of Hebrews says in chapter 4, verse 12, for the word of God is alive and active. It's alive and active, sharper than any double-edged sword. It penetrates, even dividing to the soul and spirit, joints and marrow. It judges the thoughts and attitudes of the heart. Right? This, when you understand this pattern, it's like heart and mind all working together. Like, it's getting deep within the self. Right? This also helps us to understand and maintain a fresh dimension and perspective on our faith, that Christ isn't something that happened one time and that's it. Christ is a thing that's happening. Christ is at work in the here and the now. The third reason I think this is important for us to understand is that I think this helps us to know and understand that wherever we're at in this life, whatever it is we're going through, like, it's not actually super unique and original to us. Like, we're not alone, no matter what you're going through. We're not flying blind through this life. There are those who have gone before us that have walked this path. So there's a great sense of comfort in knowing that there's this, like, kind of blueprint for this journey, that those who have gone before us have made it through, and if they can make it through, like, maybe I can as well. You know, so my hope for us in the series is that this slight shift in perspective will lead to this deeper spiritual transformation for us. That's the goal. So I hope that you'll make plans to be here over the next several weeks as we'll be diving into each gospel and kind of expanding those, these general ideas, and showing, like, how these gospels ask and answer these four critical questions. These questions that we all continually ask and go through. It's kind of nice to me, I think, to have this thought, like, oh, I can see where I'm at now in this, which means I also know how I can navigate it, which means I also know what's coming. Yeah. You know, that's the thing about the seasons, isn't it? Not that it's super great here in Florida, but in general, right, there's different aspects of each season that we all look forward to, isn't there? There's different aspects of each season that we all kind of want to, like, push back against. I don't like the heat of summer, but, you know, it is kind of nice to see everything growing. That's awesome. All my plants right now are doing great. I don't necessarily love, like, all the plants dying, but there is something nice about the coolness in the air when the beauty of the leaves changing. I don't necessarily love the coldness of winter, but also when you see that first snowfall somewhere else, right? Isn't it beautiful? Like, when you get to, like, my kids are excited to one day go get to see snow. If you live in it, you're like, eh. And then guess what happens? You get into spring again. And what are you looking forward to? Oh, the snow is melting. The flowers are starting to grow. Yeah, right? So there's beauty to each part of this path, to each section of this journey. And when you're in that, when you can see it, when you can understand it, man, it helps to navigate these things of life so much, not easier, but it just gives you, like, a sense of comfort knowing that there's a way to go through all this.
All right. Thank you, Seth, for that message. Thank you for, you know, what this series hopefully will be and become for each of us and our faith journey. We hope that you will, as I said earlier, be on this journey with us throughout. You can find videos of our sermons on our website, which is thefoundryseed.org/watch. You can also find those on our YouTube page. We are youtube.com/@thefoundryseed. If you're listening to this on Spotify, it's a video podcast as well, so you can also watch this whole thing there. And you can also find, you know, the podcast. You can subscribe wherever you found it today. If you're not already subscribed, we would appreciate that. We would also appreciate, you know, if you're on the iTunes store, rating it, leaving a review. Those sorts of things are always very helpful. All right, so that'll do it for now. For this episode of the Foundry Church Podcast, I'm Joseph, and we'll see you next time.